Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Majrita Chirimuta, a professor of philosophy, assistant professor of philosophy, in the Department of the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh. And her book, Outside Color, Perceptual Science and the Puzzle of Color in Philosophy, is just out from the MIT Press. What is color? On the one hand, it seems obvious that it is a property of objects. Roses are red, violets are blue, and so on. On the other hand, even the red of a single petal of a rose differs in different lighting conditions or when seen from different angles. The basic physical elements that make up the rose don't have colors. And surfaces that we see as having the same color, say red, do not have the same light reflectance properties. So is color instead a property of a perceptual mental state rather than of a perceived object? Or maybe it's a relation between a perceiver and an object. In Outside Color, Chirimuta defends an ontology of color that aims to capture the implicit ontological commitments of contemporary perceptual science. She argues for color adverbialism, according to which color perception is an action-guiding interaction between an organism with the appropriate visual system and the environment, and color is a property of this process. On her view, color vision is not for perceiving colors, it is for perceiving things, helping us to distinguish them from background and each other relative to the interests of each perceiver. By providing a fresh perspective on an old philosophical problem, Outside Color promises to be an influential contribution to the debate about color and about perception generally. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Majrita Chirimuta, are you there?
Hello, Carrie.
Hi. Glad to have you with New Books in Philosophy.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's lovely to have the chance to talk.
Yeah, well, it's a really, really interesting book, Outside Color. You have a background in perceptual science, which I hope you'll tell us about in a second. But the whole book kind of presents a, you know, which in a sense, a very, to me, intuitive sort of view of color, ontology of color, derived from the perceptual science and other trends actually going on in activism in particular, in cognitive science more generally than perceptual science. So it's a really exciting opportunity to be able to talk with you and present this position to the wider philosophical community. And why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about yourself, how you came to philosophy, and then how you came to write this book.
Okay. Well, I first thought about studying philosophy when I was in high school and thinking about what degree to pursue as an undergraduate, because I'm from Britain originally, and in the UK we choose our degree subjects before starting university. And throughout my high school career, I'd felt torn between pursuing a science program of study or focusing more on the humanities. And then I discovered philosophy as a way of carrying out some kind of humanistic and historical interest, writing essays and just dwelling on ideas, which fits well with also having a scientific background and scientific interest. So I ended up at the University of Bristol doing physics and philosophy and then psychology and philosophy as my interests went more in the direction of the sciences of the mind. And I was always an enthusiastic philosophy undergraduate, but then I ended up doing perceptual science for my PhD. So I went straight from Bristol to the University of Cambridge, and I did my PhD in it was a bunch of sort of related topics on human vision, where I was doing some psychophysical experiments on contrast perception, so black and white, simple stripy images and how we perceive those, and working on computational models which could explain some of those empirical results in terms of neuronal processes in primary visual cortex. So something that seems quite far away from philosophy, but I carried on studying and reading philosophy and attending seminars as a side interest, and then went back to philosophy as a postdoc. So I managed to get a postdoc with Ian Gold, who was then based at Monash University in Melbourne. He's currently at McGill. And he had the idea that we'd, the two of us would work together on color, because philosophy of color is an area of philosophy of perception which has been drawing quite strongly from the scientific literature in recent years. So this was an ideal route for me to take to do interdisciplinary work on philosophy of perception and science of perception.
Cool. So the book itself is organized, you know, somewhat informally, I guess, into roughly three parts. One is where you kind of introduce the problem. You discuss a little bit the historical background of the problem in philosophy, some of the standard, you know, realist, anti-realist, you know, relationist accounts of color. Mm-hmm. And some of the relevant, more recent, color science, how that impacts, this issue. And then the second part, you, present your own account, you know, the color adverbialism and the perceptual pragmatism, which we'll get to, later on. And then you consider a bunch of objections and respond to those. So maybe we should just start kind of from the beginning. I mean, how do you get a problem of color?
Right.
And, you know, what are the sort of standard philosophical responses to that problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the very sort of basic ways into the problem is this issue of perceptual variability. The way that things can appear to have quite different colors depending on the viewing conditions, depending on who happens to be looking at them or the states of the person looking at them, you know, whether something happens to be wrong with one's eyes that day. And in some of those cases, there isn't an obvious answer to the question, well, which is the correct appearance of that object? And I like to think that this issue bothered me quite early in my life, because I have this recollection of looking at the ground in a playground when I was in primary school. So I would have been maybe 7 or 8 years old. And there was a part of the concrete that was in shadow and the part that wasn't. And I remember asking to myself, well, how does the concrete really look? Or what's the right appearance of the concrete? If you think of color as not just hue, but also sort of the brightness of the of the light, well, then this gray sort of varies in lightness. So which is the real or the correct gray of the concrete? I remember asking myself that back then. And this issue of variability, it's a problem for the most sort of naive of naive realists. If you just think to yourself, as I guess as a child I was back then at 7 or 8 years, that, or you just open your eyes and you just see the world and there's nothing that I as a perceiver bring to that experience of the world, then that those questions are more troubling. But then if you have more sophisticated ideas and sophisticated versions of naive realism as well, these kinds of variabilities aren't a problem. You could say that, well, there's more than one chromatic property that belongs to the concrete, and different visual systems pick up on those. Those kinds of things you can get around the issue. So more work needs to be done just with variability to give you the problem of color. But other philosophers have run with that. In particular, Jonathan Cohen sort of sets that up quite nicely. But when I was working on this topic, I was more interested in the way that the philosophy of science and some of the conceptual foundations of modern science have generated this problem of color. And that brings us to the topic of primary secondary qualities, which are most associated with 17th century, early modern theories of matter, people like Robert Boyle, John Locke, and it's there in work of Descartes and Galileo as well. So this idea that matter by itself has a bunch of primary qualities which can be described mathematically, and then these other qualities which objects appear to have when we look at them, like colors and tastes when we put objects in our mouths, and smells, when those occur, those aren't properties that belong to matter in the way that we experience them to have. And so then people who advocated that distinction came up with different theories of what colors and the other secondary qualities would have to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you fast forward to sort of current context, again, there seems something maybe naive about that 17th century setup, because no one now would say, well, if a property isn't one of the basic properties of matter, then we have to be bothered that it's not really there in the world, because we typically accept that there are all kinds of real properties of special sciences, sort
right.
of the ones that aren't just physics. So there are properties of biology, properties in social science, and they're not, you know, basic constituents of matter, but no one thinks that they're ontologically problematic. But why color, I think, persists as troubling is that there's a whole qualitative dimension to color. It's color is something that is very tied up with our notion of experience. I can't help but associate color with a whole range of experiences that I have when I open my eyes. Same with taste, a whole set of experiences that I have when I'm eating my dinner. And we don't have a science of how those kinds of properties come about. So I think that's why color remains a central problem in this area of philosophy. As a stand-in for this wider problem of what to do with qualitative properties.
Right. Let me press a little bit more on what is called the color contrast effect. You have, actually, this is one of the, maybe the only philosophy book that has color plates in it, which seems, you know, very appropriate, obviously. But among the black and white plates, at least in the book, is one demonstrating the phenomenon of color contrast. So can you say you know, what that is and how that helps you show that other accounts of color are not adequate.
Right. So the color contrast effect, a basic version of this is, and I think a lot of your listeners will have come across this, is when you take a two different gray backgrounds side by side. So you have a light gray background and a dark gray background. And in the center of each of these square backgrounds, you put a mid-gray circle. And depending on what background you have, the circle will either appear as sort of a darker gray against the light gray background or a paler gray against the dark gray background. So the background is having this strong impact on the color that you perceive that same, that physically the same circle to have. And so this raises the question of, so what's the correct viewing context for seeing that gray circle? Is there a specific shade of gray that we can unambiguously say belongs to that circle? Or is color really some kind of context-dependent property? And I think that these kinds of situations do sort of give strong reason to think that color is some kind of a relational property, which I'll say more about in a minute. But I don't think it's like a knockdown effect or by itself can prove too much, because on the other hand, we have examples where there are different viewing contexts and it would seem natural to say one of those is just wrong. So if you're looking at your socks in your dimly lit bedroom in the morning and you put them on and think they're the same color and then you go outside and one looks brown and the other one looks black, you would say, oh, well, you just misperceived them earlier. So there are, you know, there are different kinds of examples that can pull you in different directions.
Okay. But you do use this at least in part to get you to the difference that you later call the sort of coloring in model or coloring book, sometimes coloring book model of color versus your view, which is what you call a coloring for model. I think this seems to be a very basic difference that, you know, kind of informs the rest of the account that you give in the book. Could you say something about that distinction?
Yeah. So one thing I would, before we go on to that, I would like to say about the different responses, so the different sort of broad brush theories that you can have, and sort of going back to what the nature of the problem is. So another way of saying, asking what's problematic about color is that we know a lot about the physics of color. We know a lot about how light interacts with matter. We know about the different wavelengths of light and how we perceive the different colors in the spectrum to have the different wavelengths of light in the spectrum to have these different colors. And we, at the same time, we know a lot about the psychology of color. So all of these surround effects and a whole bunch of other phenomena that you can go into endless varieties of them. But what's fitting all this together? So how could we fit all this knowledge together to give us sort of one theory of color which is compatible both with the physical approach and with that psychological approach? And my main motivation for exploring a relationist account is actually really this issue of how the physics and the psychology of color are supposed to hang together. Mm-hmm. And I think relationism has the edge over both physicalist theories on the one hand and mentalist or anti-realist theories on the other hand, because if you're a physicalist, you'll say, oh, well, the physical story about color, that's all there is to it. So physics tells us that perceived color should be reduced to spectral surface reflectance, which is a property describing the way surfaces reflect light at different wavelengths, for example. Or if you're a mentalist, you'll say, well, the whole story is there in the neurophysiology about how the brain processes white light at different wavelengths. But I think those are only just parts of the story, and we shouldn't be tempted to just ignore the other parts.
Okay, so the relationism takes a little bit of both.
Right.
Well, let me then get back to the coloring in versus the coloring for.
Right.
Because I believe one of the things that you say is that the coloring in, well, I'm not sure that I did get this right, but I think the coloring in model seemed to, or at least some assumption along those lines, seemed to be in the background of both the realist and anti-realist.
Right.
And that, I mean, there's a kind of a bundle of different assumptions there,
right,
about color,
yeah,
that grounds those traditional views. And you would say, well, no, you know, that whole picture, you know, non-theoretical still, that has to be transformed into what you call the color form model. So I think that, you know, explaining that might be very helpful.
Yeah. So, I'll say a bit about the coloring in view and the other sort of rival physicalist and mentalist or anti-realist positions. So I think it's tempting to think about vision as almost on this sort of pictorial model where there's a world outside your head and your eyes are these cameras and the world is projecting images onto your eyes, and then the brain has to work out what is where. And so there's this idea that the brain sort of finds out where the edges are, and then there's this color visual system which colors in those edges. And so if you ask yourself, well, what is color? Then you're asking yourself the question, well, what's the physical or objective property of those objects in the world, which corresponds to me perceiving sort of these different shades of red, yellow, and green, etc. And if you're a physicalist, you run with this idea and sort of look out there in our catalog of physical properties and you look for different candidate things. And if you're an anti-realist, you'll say, well, actually, there's nothing in the external world which corresponds to these different experiences of color that we have. So really, our brain is just making something up and projecting it onto this this vision of the external world. My idea in this alternative coloring, well, in this chapter is so to say, well, that whole framework of thinking about color vision as just enabling us to try and detect colors. And then this question about, well, if we're not really detecting any physical property, maybe this is all an illusion or a projection. I'm saying there's something wrong about that setup, and we should be looking instead at the empirical science, which is describing some surprising things that color vision does, so that go beyond any, you know, armchair ideas about sort of detecting some kinds of chromatic properties or detecting some particular physical property that we can say is color, and is actually much more concerned with the way that color vision is integrated with perception of all kinds of different features of the environment. So as I put it, coloring is for detecting objects and their edges, and coloring is for seeing how far things are away. Coloring is for working out the actual 3D contours of things. And this is an idea that Kathleen Akins has developed in her work as well. So it's been around there. And I was also introduced to it back in 2007 when I was in Montreal working with Ian Gold, and I visited Fred Kingdom's lab, and he's a vision researcher at McGill University, and a lot of his research is on the interactions between color vision and, for example, perception of shape and stereopsis he's working on now. And he has this idea about the function of color vision, which he calls color is material. So he's saying that one of the main functions of color vision is actually to help you disambiguate changes in light reaching the eye, which are due to changes in material surfaces, as opposed to changes just in the intensity of illumination. So if you look at as a scene which is illuminated by a very dappled light, say a forest floor, there's going to be a very strong luminance contrast signal. How does the brain know that that's not objects on the forest floor changing? Well, if the brain compares that to what's happening with the chromatic signal, there'll be a mismatch. And so the chromatic signal is helping the brain know what is going on materially. And you can say all this without assuming that color is any particular physical properties of objects. It's really about looking at the information that color vision is allowing you to recover about your environment. And you can be agnostic about, you know, whether color reduces to any particular property of that environment.
So I think this is one of the uses, I think, you put the color contrast effect to, is to show that that it's not really an illusion. It's actually that's the way vision works. By right. using this chromatic information to right. help you say, well, you know, you've got this circle and it's got these two different backgrounds. And in order to keep track of the circle, you need to do this.
Right. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
A more, say, visually compelling example might be, you use the example of the Blue Mountains outside Sydney.
Right.
And so this is a familiar phenomenon, you know, where things that are farther away will look more diffuse in their color, and there it's blue because, which I didn't know, the eucalyptus chemicals or something are in the air. I mean, that I didn't know that was why. But in any case, I mean, maybe you could explain this in terms of the aid that chromatic features or differences give us to see things like depth. I mean, this is one of the issues that you raised.
Right. So if you're tied to the idea that color has to be, for color to be a real property, we have to find out, you know, what kinds of things in the world outside us instantiate color, and is there a sort of particular physical property type that we can associate with color, then effects like this bluing in the distance seem problematic, because from a far distance, the mountains look like they're a hazy blue, but then if you get closer, they'll just look green. So you might be tempted to say, well, that blue in the distance, that's just an illusion. That's because we're too far away to see the color of the mountains properly. But then on the other hand, you can ask the question, well, what is color vision in this case helping us perceive? And actually it's helping us perceive the distance of the mountains. So typically in our world, things look bluer as they go further away. And also the colors become less saturated. So various vision scientists had sort of looked at this effect, especially the saturation effect, and seeing to what extent people rely on this in making their judgments about how far away things are. And it seems to be something that people do use. It's not just there's this correlation, but it means nothing to us. Actually, we use these color variations as what vision scientists call depth cues, just in the way that stereoptic vision provides us with depth cues.
Okay, so speaking of uses, I mean, in the I think chapter 5, you introduce the idea of perceptual pragmatism, where you say that that color vision is both active and interest relative.
Right.
So maybe you could explain what you're getting at with perceptual pragmatism.
Yeah. So the basic idea that I introduced in the previous chapter with the coloring in and coloring for alternative was that we should stop thinking about color vision as aiming to match inner color visual experiences to sort of candidate external properties, and then sort of building from this idea to say, well, color vision is trying to guide activity. We have perceptual systems in order to guide our activities. And I'm talking not just about humans, but all kinds of animals which have color visual systems. And so what we should do is go about and try and find out more about what those activities are. And looking across the animal kingdom, we know that different species have quite different kinds of color visual systems, and they seem to be tied to the different pursuits that those animals are involved with. Sometimes it's signaling amongst conspecifics, sometimes it's finding food, sometimes it's navigation. So that's what I mean by the interest relativity of color vision. If you look across the animal kingdom, you'll see, well, there's so many different ways you can build a color visual systems. We get explanations for why different species have the systems that they do by looking at the activities that they're performing. And how this links into pragmatism. Well, at the heart of American pragmatism, in the work of William James, say, there's this criticism of the correspondence model of truth, the idea that a statement is true just if it matches up with states of affairs in the external mind-independent world. And what I call perceptual pragmatism is the analog of this, where instead of saying that a perceptual state is true or veridical just because it matches some kind of external state of affairs, we could go and say, well, a perceptual state is true or veridical if it helps the animal get by with its activities.
Okay, so two questions there, I guess, to follow up. One is you mentioned the interests of you brought in other organisms, you know, that have visual systems or at least a color vision. But in the human case, when people talk about interest relativity in other contexts, it usually brings up a lot of other heavy baggage and personal interests, social interests, political interests, and all kinds of stuff. And so maybe you could say something about, do you just mean kind of, if you just limit it to evolutionary interests, you might say, well, but we are social creatures and that's part of our evolutionary, maybe not strictly biological, maybe, but, what sorts of interests is our color visual system relative to? That's one question. The other, I guess, was, well, answer that if you could, and then I'll follow up with the other one.
Right. So I think that we get explanations of why any particular individual human or other animal living now has the kind of color visual system that they do by thinking about natural selection and what selective pressures were on their ancestors. So, and also just evolutionary heritage aside from selective pressures, a lot of features about visual system just seem to be highly conserved, you know, throughout the evolution of animals. And they have a wide range of different contemporary functions. But anyway, the point is just that we can have evolutionary explanations about the basic physiology of color visual systems, like the particular photoreceptor types that humans have versus what turtles have and what different kinds of fish have. But that doesn't give you the whole story about interest relativity, because I think whatever the evolutionary story, there's still all kinds of open possibilities for how any living creature now might choose to use their visual system. So if you take honeybees, well, maybe the kinds of uses they put their visual systems to are fairly stereotypical because their behavioral repertoire is quite fixed. But with humans, well, we go about all kinds of unpredictable activities, aesthetic ones, communicative ones. So I think here, in that case, the interest relativity is quite open. It can include social ones and personal ones. So,
okay. So, yeah, I guess in the background there is, you know, Benjamin Whorf, I suppose, you know, who sort of most famously, I guess, you know, argued that our perception is relative to our linguistic context, right? How do you come down on Whorfianism?
I see that as a question to be answered by empirical investigation. So the people that actually look at color language cross-culturally and do the psychophysics to actually see if there's any real correlations between different basic color terms and the kinds of perceptual discriminations people make, and if there are these correlations, seeing if we can infer causation there. So I see that really as an empirical matter. So whether, you know, language impacts the kinds of discriminations that people make. Though, of course, the framework that I'm setting up makes it, you know, is completely compatible with those Whorfian effects taking place. It seems to invite the idea that they does. Well, moreover, to invite the idea that, you know, if different cultures happen to have developed different color terms because they are engaged with particular practices which make use of those color terms, and therefore they see the world slightly differently, then both of those groups will be correct, if you like, in the way that they're seeing the world relative to their own interests.
Okay. So this is sort of my other follow-up, and it does feed into the correctness issue. So on the pragmatic view, at least pragmatic theory of truth, if I said, you know, the sky is blue, to say that that's true is just to say that it's useful for me to hold that belief.
Right.
So on your perceptual pragmatist view, is would you still say, you know, the sky is blue? Would you still say that's true, or would you say that you know, it's useful for me? It's useful given my interests,
right,
to perceive it that
way.
Yeah.
So we can think of the perceptual pragmatism as giving an alternate, well, a novel analysis of what is true their means. So instead of thinking on the orthodox view that saying the sky is blue is true because the sky is blue corresponds to the state of affairs out there in the mind-independent world, the perceptual pragmatism is just saying that's true to claim that if seeing the sky is blue helps you go about some kind of business.
Okay.
I'd like to add here that I don't see that it as sort of troublingly relativistic. If we really are just talking about things like, well, what honeybees see as opposed to what human beings see. So if you have seen those sort of mock-up flower depictions of how honeybees see the world, you see everything looks grainy, but there'll be these high contrast patches in the middle of flowers, which everyone thinks helps the bees find where the pollen and nectar are in flowers. And we can't see those because we don't have UV sensitive receptors. Well, the question of, well, who's right? Are we right or are the honeybees right? It's not really a troubling kind of relativity. It seems quite natural to me to say, well, we're both right given what we need to do. If the question was about honeybee knowledge versus human knowledge and whether humans know more than honeybees do, I think the relativity would be less compelling. So,
yeah. How about like just between you and me? I mean, what grounds our use of the same color term?
Yeah, so I assume there's enough convergence in human physiology and sort of human cultural within any language group or cultural context, mm-hmm. enough training that we all sort of converge upon the same usage. So even people who are so-called colorblind, they have two kinds of cones in their retina rather than three, are consistent in how they use color terms with trichromatic individuals. So, you know, again, for practical purposes, it's useful for us to not use color terms in very idiosyncratic ways, you know, within a human community. And I think that's why, you know, troubling disagreements don't arise too much. Though, of course, if you then ask people about these kinds of issues, often you hear it say, "Oh, my husband sees things differently from me. I'll say this is yellow, and he'll say it's peach." And there are lots of cases where there are ambiguities in color stimuli, and when there are disagreements, but they do seem to be the minority of cases. And in those kinds of disputes, I don't think we can really adjudicate who's seeing things correctly or not. So X's husband or X, it's just, you know, these interesting idiosyncrasies.
Hmm. Well, that's sort of, I mean, I'll ask about the phenomenology, right, of color in a second. But let me just get to the color adverbialism, which is the ontological account that you're basing on, you know, current perceptual science. Mm-hmm. So according to that account, and you give a nice clear definition there, that colors are properties of perceptual interactions. That involve, on the one hand, a perceiver that has the right sorts of visual equipment or spectrally discriminating visual systems, and then a stimulus that has a spectral contrast that can be exploited by that type of visual system.
Mm-hmm.
So can you explain a bit more about color adverbialism?
Right. So, there's another kind of definition that I give alongside that, which is just to say that colors are ways that objects appear and also ways that I perceive those things. So by saying that colors are properties of perceptual processes, in the long definition that you just read out, is just a way of saying that colors modify these appearances and perceivings, and these are processes rather than objects. So colors modify these processes in the way that adverbs modify activities.
Okay. So let's... let me go back to the phenomenology issue.
Say more about adverbialism.
Yeah.
If you have more, because that was just the definitions. But if you had more questions,
what might be helpful would be it's a relational view or a mm-hmm. relationism, as you put it, a version of relationism. And you also contrast it with the view presented by Jonathan Cohen in his, recent book on color, the red and the real. Mm-hmm. It might be helpful if you contrasted your color adverbialism with his, I believe, dispositional account.
Yeah. So the project that Cohen gives us in the red and the real is to defend relationist ontologies of color in general. And then he defends a more specific role functionalist view of color in the latter part of the book, in which colors turn out to be functional roles of disposing their bearers to appear red, green, etc. So it's relationist because, colors are what they are in virtue of how they affect perceivers, but the actual bearers of colors, that what instantiates the colors, are ordinary objects, so red curtains, green leaves, etc. Mm-hmm. I call color adverbialism a kind of relationism because both objects and perceivers and lights and all those different relata are all involved in making color what it is, but it's the process or the interaction that goes on in color perception which is what instantiates the color, on my view, not the stimulus.
Okay. I was going to raise the phenomenology issue is, we seem to think very strongly mm-hmm. that colors look to be, properties of objects. I mean, and they're not. But why are, as you put it, our phenomenology is an unpersuasive witness, which I thought was a very nice phrase. But why? I mean, why would we have developed something that gives us, at least on your view, such a wrong view of what the world is like?
Yeah. I can't remember the context of the phrase an unpersuasive witness, because what I'd like to say now, not knowing the context, is not so much that the phenomenology is wrong, but that it's open to various interpretations. So more an ambiguous or ambivalent witness.
Okay.
If I'm looking at the room around me, the redness of those curtains, it's out there in the curtains. Well, would I say my phenomenology is telling me that it's out there in the curtains, and it looks like there's something there that belongs to the curtains? Or is there just a more general sense of stuff being out there in the world and maybe not the color specifically is out there in a way? I mean, so the point that I make about the phenomenology is that can we really say that it's color specifically as one how would you say, extractable or one dimension of experience which can be analyzed separately from the rest, which is presenting itself as out there in the external world? Or is it really that there's this complex perceptual gestalt of which color is a part, and then we read the phenomenology off of that? So I think there are so many ambiguities and complexities when it comes to this phenomenology that it's too hasty to say, well, color just looks to be out there in the world. That seems to assume that color is just one detachable part of our phenomenology, and we can just make inferences about what that is aside from what we're saying about all kinds of other stuff that's going on in our experience.
I see. So the idea that the phenomenology itself, tells us that colors are out there is actually a reflection of what you called earlier the coloring in view, and that's actually a somewhat loaded description of the phenomenology.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Okay. Let me ask you about in chapter 7, you discuss the content of color experiences, which is an important topic in philosophy. So you'd contrast two views there. One which you call a simple Russellian representational view of the content, and then you contrast this with the view that that I think you support, which you called the complex Phrygian representational view. So maybe you can give us a little background on that particular debate, and then how you come to your Phrygian or complex Phrygian view.
Right. So the previous chapter sort of presents this ontology of color, which is different from the candidate color ontologies that people are talking about. And one of the implications of the adverbialist color ontology is that objects don't instantiate colors. But if you look at the standard accounts of the content of color experience, which are coming from a philosophy of perception, it's typical to say that the content of color experience is to attribute colors to objects. So to attribute redness to the curtains. So if you hold the simple Russellian representational view of the content of color experience, I'm looking at these red curtains now, and if you, I don't know, I'm going to write down what the content is, well, the content would be, oh, those curtains are red. And that's inconsistent with color adverbialism because of this this assumption that all of the content should just be analyzed in terms of attribution of properties to objects. So I say, if you're going to be a representationalist about perceptual experience, in order to make that compatible with color adverbialism, you need to go down this Phrygian route, which says that the content is not just about attribution, but there's also modes of presentation. So we can say that on this Phrygian view that color is a mode of presentation of other non-chromatic properties of things out there in the world around us. So when I'm looking at those red curtains, there's this mode of presentation, which is this redness, and that's presenting the shape and the texture and everything of the curtain to me.
Okay. So when we misperceive a color, what is going on there?
So I was just going to say about these different representational accounts. Mm-hmm. So I sort of sketched them out to just show how color adverbialism is compatible with this Phrygian idea. I also talk write a bit about how it would be compatible with some modified version of naive realism, or what's known as relationism in the philosophy of perception, when we're not talking about color as well. So I think there are different sort of accounts of the content of color experience and all the what color experience is that can be given, like assuming color adverbialism. And you'll notice that when we start talking about color experience, just using everyday color language like red and redness, then it's you just start falling back into turns of phrases which are incompatible with color adverbialism. But I think we'll say something about that a bit later on. So that's why it's hard to convey the account in an ordinary discussion and not say things that would appear to be just straightforward inconsistent with color adverbialism. But such is the nature of language.
Right. Well, I mean, you do say something very interesting, you know, I wouldn't say it in passing, but, you know, towards the end, you say this is an issue that, that, you know, needs to be dealt with in a way. And that's the idea that, you know, our color concepts in some sense seem to be mistaken, or you don't, how do you put it? You put it that you're not worried if the actual, you know, ontology, the nature of color, really doesn't match with the with our color concepts, our ordinary color concepts. And so if there's this bifurcation between, you know, what color really is and how it functions and all that stuff, and then all these color concepts that we've developed in ordinary language or through just, you know, ordinary observation, if I can say that, actually, given what you said before about, you know, the phenomenology. So you're not worried about this the idea that the concepts we have and maybe the concepts we ought to have. I don't know if you want to say that, but they're going to be different. The scientific picture and the manifest picture, they're just going to be different. And that's, you know, do you see them, you know, just sort of, well, that's just the way it is, or any reconciliation, or how do you see them mapping to each other? Will we just be stuck with a language that's just, you know, ill-suited to the world, and that's the end of it?
Yeah. So all of that suggests that, you know, the business of science is one of sort of describing nature as it is. But if you think of science as generating concepts, you know, for its own peculiar purposes, which might not just be sort of describing nature in this godlike way, then some kind of relativism actually creeps in here. So I think what I think about this is that concepts are tools, and ordinary color concepts are fine for everyday tasks, but when we're doing the science of the mind, and when we're in particular interested in putting the science of the mind on a healthy non-Cartesian footing, then those ordinary color concepts don't serve us very well.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm tempted to appeal to authority here, but at least in thinking of concepts as tools, I've been quite influenced by Mark Wilson, who's in the philosophy department at Pitt, who in his book Wandering Significance talks a lot about the concept of red and also concept of hardness and various other concepts that occur in science and how their meanings float around depending on the different practical purposes people put them to. Mm-hmm. And that seems right to me.
Okay. I think we're actually starting to run out of time here. Let me just ask a generalization question.
Oh, I didn't answer the question about error. or misperception?
That's right. And I would like to hear the answer.
Okay. So, one of the sticks that people like to beat relationist views about color with is to say that it's too much of an anything goes view, that there's no grounds for saying ever that we misperceive color. But I think if you combine relationism with the pragmatist account, then there are paradigmatic instances of color misperception which occur, and those are ones where our business is really being interfered with because we can't resolve chromatic information properly. So I said before about, well, when you put on mismatched socks in the morning because the light is so dim, you'd say that you misperceived them in the morning when you go outside and you look more carefully. Well, that's a case where your pragmatic goal, like wearing coordinating clothing, whatever the fundamental nature of color coordination is being interfered with because of the poor lighting conditions. And there are other cases where, you know, color constancy fails and because the lighting is really strange and tricksy and you fail to re-identify objects. Those are the kinds of instances where you're strongly inclined to say, well, we're misperceiving the colors. And I think we're strongly inclined to say that because of our business is being hampered because of those strange viewing conditions.
I see.
Whereas those more neutral cases, like the different backgrounds and one circle looks slightly grayer than the other, it doesn't really matter to us. And I think that's where we can't say that one view is a misperception or not.
Okay. So to go back briefly to the generalization question, so color adverbialism, do you think that some sort of a adverbial account is appropriate for vision in general, and not just color vision, or even for sensation?
Yeah. So this is a question I've had before, and I really don't know what I think about this without having gone through all the details and worked it out to see if there is a coherent view to be had and whether that view has its attractions or not. So I think it's one of those things where the devil will be in the detail, and it would seem natural to generalize adverbialism to secondary qualities in general. But if you take on board that Phrygian view of perceptual experience, it's natural to stop with the secondary qualities and not generalize to primary qualities. So, yeah, there's different factors in play there. And without doing all the work, I don't know what I think about that.
Okay. Well, we're almost out of time, so let me just ask as a final question. Do you have another project in the same ballpark following up on this one, or are you going to something very different, or what's next for you?
So the general adverbialism, that's not at the top of my to-do list. It seems like a much bigger project to take on right now. Right now I'm sort of involved with maybe sort of tying up some of the loose ends from the book. So I would like to write more about color constancy and how this idea of colors being properties of processes might seem to conflict with the idea that color is stable or has constancy. So to actually give a more detailed account of what the mechanisms behind color constancy are, as we've learned from empirical science, and how that would mesh with color adverbialism. So that's more at the top of my to-do list. And I also have a bunch of other projects on the go, which are more philosophy of neuroscience, so actually looking at computational models of brain function, and trying to say something about the explanatory practices which go on in those fields, and how you can take a system which is as complex and hard to explain as the brain, and what kinds of inferences different models allow us to make about neural function, and how that would eventually lead to a more integrated picture of mind, brain, and behavior.
Cool. So. Very good. Well, we are out of time, so I just wanted to thank you for giving us your time and telling us all about your new book.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Majrita Chirimuta, an assistant professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh. We've been talking about her new book, Outside Color, Perceptual Science and the Puzzle of Color in Philosophy, which is just out from the MIT Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.